Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to XYZ, the podcast about CNC, automation, robotics, and space. We're going to talk about space today. How are you, Nick?
I'm good.
So the voice you're hearing, the disembodied voice, is my co-host, Nick Frank, one of the owners of Frank Brothers Guitar Company. And my name is Aaron Goff. I'm the owner of Goff Custom Knives in Toronto, Canada. So what have you been up to, man?
It was kind of not a slow week, but just one of those weeks that just, eased along. So it was kind of nice. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're only halfway through it, but
Was it like you were trying to get stuff done and it wasn't really happening, or it was just everything was pretty laid back?
No, I actually feel that way more when we're doing production work. Mm. It's like the putting out fires and random stuff that happens that, feels crazier. So like when we're just doing production, it's like, this is nice.
Interesting. So you're saying right now you're doing development work. Like what's the opposite of production?
Yeah. Opposite of production, I guess would be, doing, we are doing some development work with the Haas, but we're kind of just sticking to that on the weekends right now, just because we're a little backed up on production. And then there's just other random stuff that happens. Like, we had to replace our spray booth fan or getting new equipment. Like we got new dust collectors. We had them hooked up by the electrician this week, but that had nothing to do with me. Right. And just little things like that, or, fixing a problem, fixing a mistake on a guitar or something like that, that needed to be or a guitar that needs to be started again,
Right.
When it's just nice, smooth production, that's a good feeling.
Mm, okay, fair enough. So you were doing production, but it was just smooth.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice. That makes sense.
How about you?
Late last week, I was doing production as well. So I kind of do my production work late in the week and my development work early in the week.
Oh, cool.
I crashed through a bunch of production work late last week. Sent out a lot of knives to customers, which was awesome.
Really nice.
And then this week I've been doubling down on doing the fixture design for my upcoming kitchen knife, which is exciting.
Oh, that's very cool. How are you approaching the fixturing with that? Is it going to be very similar in a way to how you're doing the Resolute?
No, not at all. Not in any way. Yeah. So the Resolute, the way that I hold onto that is I start with a rectangular blank. I machine some locating features on the inside, so pinholes, and then I use those pinholes to hold the knife while I machine one side of the profile at a time, so the spine and then the edge. And then once I have that profile kind of 2D shape, then I heat treat it, and then it comes back and gets held by its edges, so like the spine and the edge of the blade gets held while I machine the bevels. And unfortunately, that really won't work for the kitchen knife because it's so wide and thin that if I try to put pressure between the edge and the spine of the knife, it's just going to bow. like a spring. It's going to just like warp out of the way.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that last week, but
yeah,
I couldn't think of another way. Like, I guess you're sort of the only knife maker I've watched whole like machine a knife like the way you're doing it.
Right. Yeah. So, like, what I'm going to do instead is, in a lot of ways, much simpler. Basically, I'm going to have a rectangle of steel. I'm going to heat treat it. I'm going to bolt it down at the edges. Machine all of the like the 3D features on one side, then flip it and machine all the 3D features on the other side, and then cut the profile but leave some tabs.
Right. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The tabs.
And yeah, and then the next, the kind of the most complicated bit is that I actually will have a third station for a trimming operation. So basically, I'll break the tabs by hand, and then I'll have a trimming station where it will actually. So I'm bolting it down in a way that I can get access to the full spine of the knife and the handle of the knife, and I'm going to come in with an end mill and completely trim all of the tabs and clean up the edges perfectly.
Cool. I mean, it's kind of similar how like to the way we're doing our guitar in a way.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, you're sort of starting with a block, leaving that block until the end.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So when you guys are machining a guitar body, what's the process? Like you do. Tell me what the process.
Yeah. I mean, we leave that final cutout of the guitar that right. makes it that shape right to the very end. That's like the last step on the CNC.
And how do you hold on to the guitar? Because I mean, that means you have to machine all the way around the edge.
Yeah. So you're removing. Yeah. You're removing the fixture. That was the fixture.
Right. So how do you hold on to the body while you're doing it?
We used to use tabs, but the problem was we would trim those tabs off on a router table after. So we'd cut the frame away.
Right.
We cut through those tabs on the bandsaw, but it always left a sign of where the tab was.
Right. So something about like a little like a witness mark. On the lead in and the lead out of the tab, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a triangular shaped tab. We made them as small as we possibly could. We experimented with a couple different tab shapes, but yeah, we assumed it was like, you know, it's the wood grain acting differently from one router bit to another. Like we were cutting it in a different way or applying different pressure. There was the feeds and speeds were different because one was done on the CNC, one was done on a router table.
Right.
I don't know if you could shed some light on why we were getting a witness line left, but.
Well, was like the witness mark visible right off the CNC? Like, let's say you haven't like trimmed the tabs off on your trim router and you've got the body and the tabs are still sticking out. Could you see like a little bump on either side of the tab on the body?
No.
Really?
Just underneath. I mean, once you remove the tab, you've got that wood that was underneath the tab.
Hmm.
So, I mean, we just couldn't figure out a good way to do it. We would have to sand the guitars quite a lot, and that throws things out of tolerance. Right. So now what we do is we drill, before we cut the guitar out, we drill 4 3/8-inch holes, and then we just hammer in phenolic dowel pins, and then we've got 4 holes in the our fixture plate, we those fit into the 4 pinholes in the table or the holes in the table. And then when the guitar is cut out, it's just being held in sort of in midair.
Oh, weird.
By the 4 pins.
So there's like nothing holding the pins in place. It's just kind of
just
like,
friction.
Just friction.
And the body is kind of bottomed out.
Right.
It's resting on a few different like it's not fully
floating.
Yeah, it's not fully floating. It's resting on a few points on the table. So I can't go down any further. Chatter, I mean, we're sanding this. We would like a nicer edge finish. But we're not getting crazy chatter or anything. The edge finish is pretty good. Right. And it works. To our surprise, it worked. And
if you're being really gentle with the last couple of passes where you break through, then
yeah,
sure.
And the holes are just in where the pickups go. So you never see them again. We even, during the finishing process, we fill them with wooden dowels that we make from the scrap body.
Of course you do.
Why not?
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, so the problem that I have with my final trimming operation is that it's a hard milling process. So, you know, like you're talking about like a really thin section of steel that you have to cut, and that steel is really, really hard. So,
the tool wear.
Well, and it's tool wear and it's chatter, you know. So the knife blade wants to move up as it's getting pulled up, you know, by the cutter. And yeah, that causes issues. So basically I altered the knife design a little bit to have two holes going through the handle underneath where the handle scales will go, so that I can use those to bolt the blank down.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have six toggle clamps along the length of the blade, that come in from the edge side of the blade. Because the edge side of the blade, it doesn't have to be perfect finish because I'm just going to sharpen it away anyway.
Right.
So these toggle clamps kind of reach over the blade and clamp nearer to the spine, where I'll be machining in order to like keep things settled down. But it's been an interesting process. Like this is the first time that I've actually like started choosing tooling and tool holders while I was building the fixtures.
You were using just what you had?
Yeah, pretty much. Or like, you know, trying to make something work, like being like, oh, that should give me enough clearance, you know? And this time I'm actually like, okay, I want to put a toggle clamp here. Like how much clearance does that give me? Okay, so I'll get this tool holder, try that. And then I'm actually like bringing the tool holders in from Maritool, simulating them in Fusion 360 and checking my clearance as I'm making the fixture.
Oh yeah, that sounds like the way to do it.
Yeah, and then so like I can leave like 50 thou of clearance between my toggle clamp and the cutting tool, you know.
That's scary.
Yeah, it's a little pucker inducing, but I, you know, honestly, like I can't get away with much, you know, because it's a hard milling process,
and because you just need that tool rigidity.
Yeah, at the tool rigidity and the fixture rigidity, everything has to be really, you know, tight. So yeah, it's fun though. It's been a pretty smooth process overall. It's just I've been going a bit slow trying to be thorough, you know.
I wonder if it will make you reconsider how you're doing the Resolute.
Yeah, so I would very much like to reconsider how I do my other knives, because hanging on to the edge and the spine with that clamping action, it does work, but I had to make a bunch of like specialized clamp parts and stuff in order to make it work. And it's still like there's the very final operation where you're cutting the second side of the bevel. The blade's already quite thin. Mm-hmm. So I actually have to have like two different types of fasteners in my pitbull clamps. And then one size of fastener, I only fasten by hand. Because if I use my normal like impact gun on that fastener, it actually distorts the blade.
Oh, wow.
And
so how much are you dialing it in by hand? Like, do you just know by feel or by look?
I mean, just like as tight as I can by hand with like a regular driver, you know, like I just can't do it up that tight enough to cause a problem. Whereas if I was just doing everything with tabs and so on, the same way that I'm doing the kitchen knife, I think I'd be able to hold my tolerances in Z a lot better than I can right now. Like right now it's fine because I've kind of worked out how to squint at it and like make it work properly. But like, I think it'd be a lot less fussy if I was doing it the other way.
True.
Fingers crossed. We'll see. It could be worse.
I'll be interested to see. Are you going to video this?
Oh yes. Yeah, for sure.
That trips me out when you like, I can understand machining the one face cause you have the flat reference surface still, the one bevel, and then flipping it over. It's now referencing off of the other bevel, right?
It actually references off. So it references in X and Y off the pinhole, off one of the pinholes going that hold the handle scales
positionally,
to the
right?
But yeah. And then vertically, it's actually referencing off the edge of the bevel. So yeah, it does reference off the edge.
But like not the whole position. Face of the bevel. the machine bevel.
No. And my the original versions of my fixture, basically I didn't like 3D machine the fixture to perfectly fit the bevel. I probably should have, but I didn't. And it still does work. I do actually have two set screws that are underneath the bevel on the second side that I can tune up or down to dial the position of the blade. But it's fuzzy.
Right.
Like if I had just done a full 3D machined thing, like I did on my most recent fixture, I'm not sure if you saw that video where I did like a second generation fixture.
I did, the black one.
Yeah. Yeah. So that one, the support underneath the second side of the bevel is fully 3D machined. And that I think makes a lot more sense.
Did you go over that in the video?
Yeah, I showed it. I don't know if I like called it out explicitly, but yeah. So yeah, it's going to be fun. And I've decided previously, so I have two CNC mills, Millie and Vicky.
Right.
And previously Millie, the idea with Millie was that I would keep, her separate and not do any production processes on that machine, to keep a machine free for doing R&D. Mm-hmm. But I think it's just limiting my throughput too much. And I haven't been using that machine enough for doing R&D. So I'm actually going to dedicate that machine to doing the kitchen knife.
Oh, cool. And is Millie the one that's not enclosed?
Yes, Millie's my older machine. Yeah.
So you're not using flood coolant, right? Or any type of coolant?
No, I don't use... Well, I just use air blast and that's it.
Right. That's cool. I mean, we don't use flood coolant, obviously, but...
don't get some flood coolant in on the wood.
Maybe it would help. I don't know.
Maybe. Wood. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so like flood coolant is really critical for machining aluminum because the aluminum will melt at the cutting edge and weld itself onto the tool.
Oh, right.
That's not really a concern with steel, and with like modern coatings like aluminum titanium nitride on like a carbon tool, a carbide tool. Mm-hmm. The coating kind of reflects most of the heat of the cut so that it stays in the chip, and then the chip gets thrown away from the tool,
right,
and away from your workpiece. So, you know, everything stays pretty cool. And then if you add in an air blast, like the air blast is mainly to make sure that the chips get away from the tool and don't end up getting recut. Because like if you have a bunch of chips that are just getting recut, then you'll tend to chip your cutting tool much more quickly.
Right. And is that cooling the tool as well?
It is, yeah. I mean, in my case, I have the air blast set up so that it's blowing chips away, but it's also cooling the workpiece and cooling the tool.
Right. You don't want to touch those during the cut to make sure they're not hot.
No, that's always messy when you do that. But I mean, like I can pull a blade out of the machine, like, you know, seconds after it's finished machining and it's totally cold.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Like during the process, if I let the tools get too dull, then you can get some heat,
right,
but it's still very little.
It is wild to me that a coating that thin, however thin it is, does anything. A
couple of microns. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, you can just use uncoated carbide to cut steel dry as well, but it just doesn't work quite as well. Hmm.
It's cool. Well, that's rad. Yeah.
Yeah, really?
I'm going to go ahead and change our show notes back from Comic Sans. That's driving me nuts.
Is it? So, Nick, I put a little note in our show notes saying, like, I see you, and then an emoticon, and he said, I hope you like Comic Sans, and he changed everything to Comic Sans. It was
making me barf. It's nice.
It was
cheering me up, but I've had enough.
You've had enough comic for the day.
Yeah.
So, look, I know everyone's going to be wondering, how's the Haas going? Did you crash it yet?
Oh, yeah. No, we have no crashes. We're kind of backed up on production. So it's a chicken and egg thing. But we are doing the, we're making our fixturing this weekend.
Okay. So now Mark's, I'm curious, when you say you're, sorry.
And we think we have everything we need.
Fingers crossed. When you say you're backed up on production, are you backed up because you got too many orders or because production hasn't been going smoothly?
More a backlog of orders.
Oh, that's great, though. That's a good problem to have.
It is, you know, as, but at the same time, you know, it's we wanted the liver, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a bit stressful when you give people an estimated completion date and that drawing close or you're past it. And you're like,
yes.
Plus, the other thing we do, which is really challenging to keep up with, is we give customers photo updates, which people really love. But it's hard to find the time to bust out the camera and snap a couple pics and then upload them, go through everyone, all, you know, the whole SD card and pull photos for each customer. It's really something we want to continue to do because we have a long lead time. Right now, our lead time is like 6 months. So it's a long time to wait without anything.
Right.
For an expensive objet. But
so, I mean, this sounds like a perfect opportunity to do something, you know, like this is why I love software development. So like, you know that I was a software engineer in my last real job, you know, so if I was facing that challenge, I'd probably like throw together a little web app that you could like, you know, pick from your open orders, click on the open order on your phone, and then take a photo of whatever's happening on your phone. And it would just update it straight to that order.
Well, that's
and send
cool
a notification to the customer, you know.
When are you available to do that for us?
Oh, I would love to do that. It sounds fun. Sounds very fun. Yeah, I well, we can talk about this in a second. I want to hear more about the Haas. So,
so
working on the fixture plates?
Yeah. So, when we got our Axis machine, we did all the fixturing, prototyped it with MDF.
Right.
Like MDF, it's a miracle material.
It's pretty good stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Particularly if you get the nice stuff. Like the Home Depot stuff is like not great, but if you go to like a, you know, a proper lumberyard, get like the stuff they use for cabinet making, like that shit's pretty good.
Now, you're going to like this, but I feel a bit hosed, but I did buy MDF from McMaster.
Oh, wow. Okay.
You've bought toilet paper from McMaster before, so you can't bust my chops. You did. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like something I would
do.
Yeah,
for sure.
A friend and I had a challenge to try and find something that was edible on McMaster. Like actual food. And
there has
we did
to be
find
some
it.
Oil or something. That's...
No, we did find it. You can buy like goldfish or something
no.
on there.
Oh, yeah. I bet you they have too. Like places like industrial supply companies like Grainger or Uline have like thirst quenchers or some shit. Goldfish?
Right. Here you go. I found it. Swedish fish.
Shut
Snacks
up.
Snacks cannot be sold to Canada due to import regulations.
So you can't eat it.
I can't eat it. But if you're in the States,
that
you
is
can 100%
hysterical.
Buy
$34
food on
bucks
McMaster.
For 24. Wow, they know how to get you. Cannot be sold to Canada exclusively. Do they ship to anywhere other than Canada and the United States?
I don't believe so.
Wow, that's tragic.
So wait, you bought MDF from McMaster?
Yeah.
How was that?
You know what? I mean, I haven't checked how much the shipping was because they never tell you. But I was getting sheet material already.
Right.
Of the exact same size. So everything's closed here
and then
right
you
now.
Bought
exactly. We bought phenolic. Right. But I can't go to Home Depot. Home Depot's completely backed up.
Right.
anyway, so yeah, we bought 1-inch thick black phenolic.
Ooh. That sounds fancy.
And Garolite, as they call it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me get the deets on it. Got it right here. Economical Garolite XX. And
was it flat when you got it?
It's got a curve to it. A little bit of a curve to it.
Yeah, I bought some off there a while ago, thinking that maybe it'd be good material for knife handles, and every sheet that I got came with like a 1/2-inch bow in it. And this is in like a 1-foot by 1-foot sheet.
Oh no.
Yeah, it was
we got 24 by 36 and it's got a subtle arc.
Right.
But
once you bolt it down, it'll be flat.
Yeah, exactly. And we're doing quite a lot of big
bolting.
13 or 1/2-inch 13.
Right.
Is that it? Yeah.
Half 13.
Half 13. Bolts.
Right. So you guys are gonna use the MDF to make your prototype fixtures and then
we're not actually. We're gonna use the MDF to just put down to and then put the phenolic on top to surface it. On the Axis machine.
Oh, okay. So you're not making your fixtures in the
We are. House? We're just doing a rough surfacing for one side and then we're just really familiar with that machine. We're nervous, baby steps.
Right.
And we've got like junky tools that we can do some rough leveling. Because this is going to be a vacuum fixture plate.
Oh, okay.
So we're doing a 1/4-inch bottom, and then we're going to have the vacuum in the 1-inch top part. It's going to be sandwiched between
right.
The vacuum portion is going to be sandwiched in there.
Right, so you'll have like a vacuum spreader underneath
yes.
that lets the vacuum get to all the parts of the plate, and then you'll drill through from the top plate.
Yeah, and all that's going to be done on the Haas, all the vacuum pod machining.
Right.
So the other thing we got is a Saunders Machine Works fixture plate.
Oh, you bought one of
we
those?
We did.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Do you like it?
It's beautiful. Nice. I'm quite impressed with it. So I like, you know, I looked at them. I was like, these are nice. Like, they're cool. I don't really see what the use for us is right. because we're basically going to be filling out that entire surface with our fixture, right. our vacuum fixture. So we're kind of making our own fixture plate.
Right.
But with our machine table, we've got the T slots, and we're making our fixture out of phenolic. So right. We would have a significant portion. And we're going to be spanning the whole 20-inch width of the Y travel. Right. And the table's only 18. And then inside that, maybe 6 inches in on either side of the table, you've got your T-slot. So there's a lot of unsupported material.
Gotcha.
If we were machining our fixture plates out of aluminum, which we plan to do down the line, but we're familiar with this material and it works.
Yep.
We like it. We're not machinists, really. We're not you know, comfortable.
Phenolic is like in between wood and aluminum.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. Anyways. I'm sure it's good enough. Honestly.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So we looked into buying aluminum to make right. our own, and it's like $1,200. It's fully machined. It's got like 900 holes in it.
Right.
That have a tight tolerance bore and then threaded underneath.
Right.
And so
you can use like shoulder bolts.
Exactly.
In any location. Right.
Yeah. So it allows us to clamp down, to bolt down our fixture plate to this fixture plate. And it's 20 by 36. It's bigger than the table. It's the Haas table.
Mm. Right.
So okay. it was in to buy aluminum in that size was not that much cheaper. And he's right. done it, and it's anodized black, and it's very pretty.
Yeah.
So nice. it was we were, at a certain point we were just like, fuck it, let's do it. Let's just do it.
Yeah, sweet, man.
And it shipped like right away. It came very well packaged.
Hmm.
So yeah, it made our lives easier so far.
Well, I mean, John Saunders has been, I've seen a lot of his videos. You know, he's the NYC CNC has been around for a long time,
mm-hmm.
very much like talking the talk. They always looked like they were, you know, on top of what they were doing. So it's very cool to see that they're, you know, walking the walk as well. But
yeah, it did give me make, you know? Confidence in his in that brand because he's so outspoken, and yeah. they did deliver. I will say it was a nice experience. I didn't actually speak to anybody there.
Right, just place the order.
I just placed the order, and it came really fast.
Right.
So
nice.
Yeah, and it's very nice piece of aluminum.
Very cool. Well, yeah. I mean, it's crazy how fast tooling costs and stuff add up for a new machine.
Oh man. Yeah, it's wild. We've been buying tooling from Mari Tool, and also yep. great experience.
Yeah.
But we're just buying one piece at a time. You know, I pictured myself just being like, okay, because when you know when you're budgeting and stuff, you
mm-hmm.
you go, this is how much it is for 30 tool holders, 30 collets, 30 tools or whatever.
Right.
And it's a lot of upfront money, cash flow mm-hmm. wise. So we've just been picking away at it one piece at a time, or I mean, like 6 pieces at a time. Or so I did actually order from Mari Tool, bit the bullet and bought their tool length and diameter probe.
Oh, the tool calibration.
Yeah.
Tool probe calibration tool.
Yeah. Yes. For setting the Renishaw probe, because we're going to have to move it.
Right.
And that's something you should do, I think.
Periodically.
Periodically.
Yeah.
So you know, it's kind of just nice. Like it's again, one of those things. It's like, I mean, DIYing, it's not even that DIY. You just put a
plug gauge plug or a gauge, dowel pin or something.
Yeah, in a tool holder. But this is nice. It's like got the tool, the tolerances or the length and diameter marked out on it. And
sometimes it's just nice to have the right tool.
It's just nice. It's not that you're not saving that much money, really. Yeah. It was $240 versus a tool holder, collet, and plug gauge was like going to be, I don't know, $180.
Well, one thing. So if you're ordering from Maritool a bunch, I forgot to tell you this previously, that they are introducing FedEx shipping for Canada. Mm. So if you put in your order notes, like, please ship with FedEx, then they will ship with FedEx. And for me, it worked out like just a tiny bit more expensive than UPS, but like the duties and stuff when it came across the border was way less.
Oh, okay. Interesting. I haven't...
UPS standard, they charge you like brokerage fees out the ass.
I didn't see a brokerage fee and I have an account with them. So they probably just dinged me on my account.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, whereas I don't have an account with them purely because I really dislike them. And they're always like, you could create an account. And I'm like, I don't want to. I don't want to use you guys.
How do you ship your product?
DHL.
Ah, so we just made the switch to DHL.
Yeah. So I used to ship everything with Canada Post, but then when COVID hit, the US postal system and the Canadian postal system were so overrun. That things got really slow. And then to other countries, like, so I shipped, I think it was to the Ukraine. I shipped a knife for a customer to the Ukraine, but it took 7 months to get there. And like Canada Post told me they'd lost it. And then like 5 months later, it showed up at the guy's place.
You're kidding. What had you done in the meantime?
Anything? I refunded him his money. I can't like hang on to his money for that whole time, right? So... yeah, I've been really impressed with DHL so far. I haven't had a single thing go missing. Like shipping to the US, sometimes it's next day. You know, like they say it's like 3 days, but like sometimes it shows up like the day after, which is crazy.
We haven't had that experience. We also haven't had a bad experience yet.
Right.
I mean, eventually you will with any shipping company.
Yes, of course.
That's really fast. I mean, it's not that fast for us.
Well, it varies. So like more recently, it's been more like 4 to 5 days. I think they're just getting slammed.
Yeah. Okay.
And then it depends where too, you know, like if you ship to New York, then obviously it's just geographically closer.
Yeah. What's interesting about DHL too, is the rate for the US is fixed. So whether you're shipping to, at least this is for us, shipping to the US, shipping to New York from Toronto, which is quite close, or like California.
Texas. Right.
It's the same price.
It's not for me, but it's pretty close. You know, it's like a couple of dollars difference. Right. It's like 30, 33 versus 35 or something. You know, it's not that bad.
But we made the switch because FedEx was super expensive.
Mm-hmm.
UPS was super slow, and they were charging our customers a brokerage fee.
Yeah,
which we used to cover. Because we had a broker. So we had a commercial broker. Right. It was $15 for us. It was $50 for the customer.
Yeah.
So we were covering it. And then we stopped doing that because we were having, in the US, for US customers, we were having to collect their SSN number, the social. Brokerage needs social for anything valued over $2,500.
Right.
Or the customs does. So that was uncomfortable. And so we started letting them broker it themselves or with UPS, and it was $50. And then you add that to the standard shipping rate, the average shipping rate with UPS, and it was the same price as DHL. But DHL is air, it's typically faster, and they don't ask for a SIN number, and brokerage is included.
Right.
So it was win-win.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, it's amazing to me how much of pain in the ass every aspect of running a business is. You know, it's not like, oh, you just use a shipping service and it just works fine.
No.
Like, every single thing from like sourcing cutting tools to shipping to, you know, like what kind of tape are you going to use? What kind of labels are you going to use to like print on your boxes? Like, every single part of running a business is a pain in the ass.
It's true. I have like 30 tabs open, not literally, but one is a label printer. One is your Kanban. I don't know if that's if I should have been talking about that, but one is Uline. One is a template for doing inventory. Like, nothing simple.
Yeah, nothing is simple. It's crazy. Yeah, and I was doing my books, like my quarterly kind of update this week, and I was just like, oh god damn, I'm not making anywhere near enough money for all the work that I'm doing.
Yeah.
I think I'm making like $16 an hour at the moment. Yeah. It's just like brutal.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, the problem is that, like, you know, if you were working at like McDonald's or something, then like $16 an hour is pretty good. Yeah. But like $16 an hour in a business, all it takes is like one machine to break down and it wipes out your income for like a month or more.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm preaching to the choir here, but
like, well, you work like, you know, an 80-hour work week or something like that, and you,
yeah, it's a bit brutal.
You eat what you kill.
Yes,
it's a gross way to say it, actually. I said it out loud, but
well, I mean, that's part of the reason why I'm excited for the kitchen knife coming up, because it's really going to expand my market.
Mm-hmm. That is super cool, and expand your market in a, I would guess, a really different place.
Yeah.
Like a completely different market, rather.
Different customers, different. Yeah. So I'm excited about it. And I'm also just super excited because, like, you know, I've got prototype kitchen knives in my kitchen, but I don't have like the real one yet because I haven't made the real one.
Yeah.
You know, I want to get it happening.
I'm excited for that too. That's going to be really cool.
Yeah, man.
Are you going to do like late night commercial demos where you slice a pineapple in half in midair?
A shoe. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. 100%. You saw a shoe in half.
I actually had a conversation with a friend the other day. He was like, oh man, I'm so looking forward to your knife. I'm so sick of cutting my tomatoes up with my hands.
Hmm?
He's been like karate chopping them, you know?
Oh, of course.
And I think that's probably going to become the, like, you know, the late night infomercial. He has volunteered to karate chop some tomatoes.
Yeah, that guy sounds out of touch.
Yeah,
unhinged
before the Stone Age. Yeah. So I'm excited, dude, because I just saw just before we started recording that SpaceX finally got their latest Starship prototype to fly. I don't know if you saw this because it just happened.
I did not.
So Starship SN15,
the tweet alert.
Oh, I didn't use the tweeter. But yeah, Starship SN15 went up and it did its 10-kilometer test flight and came back down and landed under its own power, right on target, and didn't explode at all.
Wow, it looks cool.
It's super, super cool, man.
I mean, it looks like a spaceship.
But it looks like what you imagined a spaceship looked like as a kid.
Yeah, okay, it looks like the future. It looks like an older generation's futuristic vision of a spaceship.
Retro futuristic.
Yes. It's kind of bare bones, I will say.
Yeah, I mean, it's still a prototype, right? Like, they're literally, like, flying these things. So, like, the one that they flew today is, you know, basically, like, stainless steel.
Yeah.
Everywhere. No paint, no nothing. It's got a small patch of heat shield tiles on the belly just because they're, like, testing out how to attach them. And then that's it.
Wow.
Because there's, like, a 50-50 chance that it might blow up. So, like, why are they going to paint it? You know?
So... Tell me how this thing differs from a normal one. It's reusable?
Fully, yeah. So the goal with Starship is that it's going to be fully reusable. So like first stage, second stage, everything is reusable. And when they say reusable, they mean that like you land it, you know, check it really quick, you know,
fuel
like
it up.
A couple of hours to make sure it's not damaged,
that's
fuel
it
up, and fly it again. Yeah. Yeah, Elon says that he wants like a 24-hour turnaround. From like landing to having that same Starship doing another mission.
What is their plan? Like what are these spaceships flying into space so frequently for? Delivering satellites?
Missions to Mars, missions to the moon. Delivering satellites. Like orbital manufacturing could become a thing if it's cheap enough, right? What? Like there are types of crystals and stuff that you can only grow in microgravity. So, you know, like maybe specialist products will start getting manufactured in orbit. And like things like that are only economical if you can, you know, launch and land cargo cheaply.
Mm-hmm.
And right now you can't. But in the last 3 weeks, SpaceX has had three launches. Like their speed of, or three launches plus the SN15 test launch.
Wow.
Like their speed of launch is insane these days. SpaceX have a project called Starlink, which is an orbital constellation of satellites that will provide internet service to the whole world.
Right. Mark has Starlink at his house.
Oh, what, your CNC guy has Starlink? That's amazing. It's already providing service to people, but the number of satellites in orbit is only like less than a third of what it's supposed to be in the end. But they've got 1,500 satellites in orbit already, and they're going to have another 3,000 in orbit by the time the constellation's finished. But that 1,500 satellites, like, I think they launched most of that in the last year.
Wow.
You know, like, they're launching, like, 60 satellites in a single launch. But, like, it is crazy. They've done 25 launches already, you know, in the last, I think it's, like, the last year, year and a half. To get this thing operational, you know? So yeah, it's, I don't know. I think it's one of those things where, like, we really don't know exactly what's going to come out of it until, you know, the average business realizes that they can, like, put stuff in space. Like,
right.
God, you know, who knows what they're going to come up with?
The commute though, am I right?
I'd take it, man. It sounds like fun.
No, not for me.
not for Nick, because he's a big wuss.
No.
Yeah. Then, you know, a little bit closer to home. So I Nick and I share links with each other throughout the week as we, you know, see exciting stuff. And one of the things that really blew my mind this week was from Disney, of all people. It's actually not super recent. It's like from a couple of years ago. And
that's from a couple of years ago?
Yeah. Yeah. So Disney World in Japan were making like a Beauty and the Beast ride. And for the ride, they have these like animatronics, these like robots that act as like Belle or as the horse, or, you know, at all these characters out of Beauty and the Beast. And
sounds like we got a Beauty and the Beast fan on our hands.
My girlfriend's a Disney maniac.
So, oh, nice.
Yeah, you know, I have to know. But these things, like, you saw the video, right? They look like an animation brought to life.
Yeah. No, it really does.
It looks crazy how smooth they are and stuff.
If you picture like in animatronics, like the jaw is just like, it looks
flapping,
like, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And these, yeah, like they're the skin is like,
yeah, it looks like someone wearing like a cartoon suit.
Yeah, it's and then got a real Buffalo around. Bill vibe.
Okay.
Somebody else's skin over top of,
right. Well, but then I don't know if you saw the bit of the video where they show the inside of the animatronic arm, and this thing is just packed with like actuators and cables, and like it looks like way more involved than like an industrial robot. It's just super super cool that something that fancy is getting used for entertainment, I guess.
I'd be happy if they sent those things to space, put those in orbit.
Like, because you want that them away from
yeah,
you? Or...
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, it's been ages since I've been to Chuck E. Cheese, but they have that whole scene going on, don't they? Like the animatronics. And so
I've never been to a Chuck E. Cheese, but I've seen what you're talking about in movies and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Maybe I'm thinking of like the Griswold Family Vacation. Anyways, yeah, obviously there's a market.
Well, and I think the Chuck E. Cheese animatronics are very like creepy and rickety, you know, like they obviously look fake, but it's like a mannequin's come to life and it's trying to murder you or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the Disney ones look like you would expect to like walk around it and see that it's flat because it's like animated. It's like drawn,
right?
You know, like, but it's in three dimensions somehow. It's just creepy. Yeah.
It is cool.
Well, okay. So if you're creeped out by robots, have you seen, the Boston Dynamics dance video? The most
that
recent...
was more terrifying.
And then I don't know if you've seen, so there are these robots called hexapods that are like spiders, So they have like a body and six legs. And I'll have to send you the video, but there's a guy that has one of these that he made himself and he programmed it. And this thing runs.
No.
So it's like 2 feet across, a giant black mechanical spider. And this thing runs like full speed. It's awesome.
Wow, that's horrifying.
Right? I would love to have one of those and just take it for walks with me to and from work.
Yeah, along with your
little kids screaming, running away down the street. It'd be hilarious.
With your dog.
I don't think my dog would like that, man. She's literally scared of cardboard boxes that sit on the ground and don't move.
Yeah. So well, this would certainly be not terrifying. Fun for her.
Terrifying, right? So we got a couple of listener questions. Do you want to do some listener questions?
Yes, yeah.
So Made Lyle Style on Instagram asked, what is the most useless tool you own? He says, for me, it's a tie between a scroll saw and Harbor Freight drill bits.
I don't have Harbor Freight, but...
I heard a story once about someone buying a drill bit from the dollar store. And then as they used it, it like unrolled. It like untwisted. It like straightened out.
That's great.
All right. Yeah, that doesn't sound very helpful. Well, we have, I think Princess Auto is probably the closest Canadian equivalent to Harbor Freight. But I'm not ashamed to admit that I have gotten some useful stuff from Princess Auto.
Oh, yeah. If you need like an arbor press or something like that.
Yeah. My shop crane. Like an engine hoist.
My ex-shop crane.
Yes, you guys kept it in your shop for like 2 years. Very graciously for me.
We borrowed it, and then you borrowed floor space.
Yes.
And our shop borrowed for
it,
2 years.
And then I just never reclaimed it for like 2 years.
Yeah.
But I mean, that thing's done a lot of work for me. Like I've moved lathes, compressors, parts of my CNC mills. That's
Yeah, I think if you're not looking for something that requires precision... Probably the right place
anyway,
to go.
Anyway, we're talking about useful tools right now. That's way off topic. Useless tool?
Right. Oh, I see.
Most useless tool.
You go first. I need to think about this for a sec.
You know what? I'm trying to think too, because I feel like every useless tool that I have, I toss it out or I give it away.
Yeah. Or you hate using it, but you have a use for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have these real shit clamps, but I always use them for like just random ass shit.
Hmm.
But I do have an answer, but you go first.
No, I can't think of something, so I think you need to go first.
Tool cabinets. Hate them.
What, really?
Hate them.
Why?
They're just junk collectors.
Mm.
What? It's discrete storage, and discrete storage for us equals mess, disaster.
Clutter.
Right. Yeah, like we have several of them, and I would bet that maybe there's three drawers out of like four entire cabinets that actually hold something that I regularly use.
Right. But are the other things in those cabinets like stuff that you know you need to use at some point, but you don't use every month?
It's the kind of thing that you'd be like, I don't even know why. Why do I have hacksaw. I mean, that is a handy thing. That's like
that's a handy
thing. Something random like that. But it doesn't need to be in a $300 tool chest.
Right.
You can hang that on the wall.
Mm. Yeah, I have like Rubbermaid containers. I have like blue Rubbermaid containers. So if like I don't need something organized, then it just goes in a Rubbermaid container. Other things that are similar, you know.
We have a similar thing. We have old frog boxes after we had a shop flood years ago, and we had to move the entire shop out, and we just loaded a bunch of stuff into frog boxes, which is like a rental box company, a bin.
Okay.
And then we ended up buying a couple off of them. We haven't removed the stuff from them since that.
Right.
But this is what I'm talking about. This is discrete storage, and it's like you should get rid of that stuff. The day you need it, go buy it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, so I really like tool cabinets personally, but like I tend to organize the hell out of them.
Yeah. Okay. You do like the foam.
Yeah. So I have some like 3D printed dividers. I've got some drawers that are like kind of just full of stuff rattling around.
Yeah.
But it's all the same stuff. You know, like I have a drawer full of screwdrivers. You know, like, I know where my screwdrivers are because they're all in that drawer. You know, but yeah, for like the one that really bugs me is like, I have like 1,000 different air fittings, you know, push to connect fittings, 1/4 inch MPT, 1/8 MPT, like, and they're all in a blue Rubbermaid container. And every time I need to find one little fitting, I have to pull out like 50 Ziploc bags and find the right one.
Yeah.
That bugs the shit out of me. I really
I'm the
want
same
like
way.
A wall of bins or something. So
we have a bin cabinet, like a from Uline. It's just got those red bins. And we bought it to organize parts for assembling guitars. But it just always became a bit of a mess because you're pulling them in and out and in and out so often. So I think that what we that would be good for is something like having, you've got NPT fittings, you've got like, so you say you have like a, one of those is reducers, one of those is quick connects, blah 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 blah, like, and you've got 25 bins like that. That would be cool. But for everyday use, I find something like that is just gets cluttered.
Right. Yeah, 100%. I still can't think of what my most useless tool is, honestly. Like, I don't know. Sorry, Lyle. I don't know.
That was a useless answer, Aaron.
Yeah, I know. Useless. Terrible. And we had another listener on Instagram, Samurai Machine Tools, and he's actually getting a small business started making CNC mills, and they look pretty damn cool.
I checked them out. They look very cool.
Yeah, kind of like the size of a Tormach, but like way more serious, you know, BT30 spindle and...
Yeah, it's like a...
full enclosure and everything.
Yeah, it looks pretty legit.
So yeah, if you're interested in a machine like that, I think he's getting set up to do another Kickstarter to try and get this off the ground. So go and check out Samurai Machine Tools on Instagram. And yeah, I like seeing small businesses, you know, young entrepreneurs, like new entrepreneurs getting into stuff, right? It's exciting.
Yes, we'll follow that. That'll be really neat.
Mm-hmm. So we last week we said we were going to do the Aaron Reed's mean comments section, and I didn't think that I was going to have any. And then like three douchebags made a comment about my lazy eye all in within the course of like 2 days on YouTube.
What kind of assholes?
I know, man. I know. I don't even really know if it's, honestly, I don't think it's even constructive. It's not like they're even like taking apart my process or my knives or whatever. They're just being like, oh, you got a weird eye, bro.
What the fuck?
Honestly, man, you'd be amazed how many of these comments I've gotten over the years. Like, probably thousands at this point.
No way.
Yeah, it's stupid, man. Like, probably two a week for the last 6 years.
You know? It's unbelievable.
It's just stupid.
You're beautiful just the way you are, Aaron.
Thanks, buddy. And as so many people on YouTube have pointed out, I can see two things at once. That sounds like an evolutionary advantage to me.
But you can't.
No, I can't. But people have a hard time sneaking up on me because I've got a really broad peripheral vision. So, you know.
At least you're a sport about it.
What are you going to do? What are you going to do, right? Did you get any mean comments this week? Anyone?
Well, you're not going to read them?
You up? Ah, fuck these guys. Okay, yeah. Not even worth the time.
I actually tried to look. I haven't been posting this week a lot. So, this is a pro tip, Aaron. That's a key, good way to not get mean comments.
Just never post. There you go.
Perfect. Yeah, but it made me think back to like when we first started, people just being like, oh, that's super ugly, or that's way too expensive. I wouldn't pay more than $1,500 bucks for that and shit like that. And it's like, it made me think of the reason behind this segment to encourage people who are building or making things to just ignore that shit, because it does get better.
Well, and if you'd listened to those guys, you would have had like a $1,500 guitar
that looked like a Telecaster.
Right. And you'd never make any money off it, and you probably would have gone out of business by now.
Yeah. So keep at it, or, you know,
ignore the haters, as the kids would say,
or keep it coming, haters.
Right. Well, so what's your plan for this week? What are you gonna be up to this week?
I gotta catch up on some. So I do all like the woodworking portion of the guitar making.
Isn't that like all of it? Isn't the whole thing wood?
Oh, right. As opposed to finishing.
Yeah. So even like
your brother Tim does finishing.
Yeah, we've got some people here that work with us. A growing team of skilled craftspeople.
Exciting.
So somebody is like doing all the pre-finish sanding, so all the sanding the guitars and getting them ready for finish. But right. I'm assembling the parts and machining them. So that is what I really like doing. But also, before the guitars are assembled, I also make all the parts, a bunch of the parts like pick guard, pickup rings. I do the routes for the pickups and electronics and stuff like that. And right. So always like once a month or twice a month, Tim's like, I need you to do post finish routes and plastics, and it just like completely screws up my derails my happy place, which is the woodworking portion. So I have a bunch of that stuff to do.
So I have a similar thing, actually, which is sheets. So for my knives, I make thermoformed plastic sheets out of this material called Kydex. And I tend to do it like in a big batch because I kind of hate doing it. So every like 2 months, I'll just spend a day making like 60 sheets or something.
Right.
And one thing that I always think about is like it would be way easier to like get this to a point where you can just do it inline, like on demand. You know, have you thought about trying to do that with like pick guards?
How we do it. We do it on demand.
But you're talking about doing like a bunch of pick guards at once for Tim as he requests it, right? Are you just doing one?
For a few for whatever guitars need to be to go at the door or get assembled.
Right.
Maybe like two or three guitars at a time.
So how come it derails you? Just because you're having to like set up different fixtures or different
tools? Another tool set, and then it's just everything takes time, you know. And this is an annoying little thing, but we use a bunch of different little plastic, like types of plastics for pickguards. Let's say they're all all different thicknesses.
Well, and you use some interesting stuff too, like cellulose and so on that most people aren't using. Right?
Yeah, and weird stuff. So like that's a good example. The cellulose acetate pickguard, which is like tortoise shell, like what sunglasses or glasses frames would be made out of. We get that, and it's in a really rough state, the sheets of it, and we have to sand it and polish it just like you would a finish, a lacquer finish.
Oh, really? Like you have to sand the face and back of the sheet?
It's rough. It's like saw cut. And so we are sanding it from 220 up to 2000 and polishing it, and it looks beautiful, but because of that, you get a variance in thickness, and we're countersinking for screws. So I'm having to stand there and do in chamfering. I'm having to stand there and do offsets for every different material or for like a pick guard, those three holes that screw the pick guard to the body that are. Have countersinks could all be different offsets.
Oof. So is that one of those times where like maybe going back to a manual process would be like less painful? Could you just like drill the holes and then have like a piloted countersink with a depth stop?
That's not a bad idea.
Do it on the drill.
We've never done that. So I'm not even familiar with what that tool looks like and how good a finish it would leave or if it would mar the surface. I have no idea. So it may be worth looking into.
Yeah. This is one of the things that I always find really interesting about talking to people about the process is that like, you know, so when Mike was coming on board with me to work at my last shop making knives, you know, he would ask questions because he just didn't know the process and he didn't know the answer. And sometimes answering that question, I'd be like, wait, why am I doing it this way? You know, like this is dumb. Why am I, you know, I'm not saying that your thing is dumb, but like sometimes we just do dumb stuff because we're in the habit of doing it.
It kind of is because, you just, it's the way you know how to do it and it's the status quo for you.
Right.
Sticking with it is easier than solving the problem sometimes.
Yeah, right.
So you're going to get super fancy with that on the Haas and like use the probe and
yes, 100%. See, that's my solve. Right. Like I want to, yeah, probe the material. You know, like so the acetate thing, that also is a process problem. Like we could be more considerate about thicknessing them, and we're talking like maybe there'd be a variance of 5 or 10 thou, which can do a lot.
Yeah, but it's enough. It's enough. Yeah.
So we could dial that in. And
what about countersinking a little bit below the surface deliberately so that your screw is like slightly lower than flush?
Yeah. Yeah.
And to take up the variance.
And often that is the case anyways, because you're kind of guessing on these, on the countersink offset. Right. So that might be a good thing to do. Still, I'm, you know, the difference in thickness between that and a multiply black pickguard. Or a batch of multiply versus like an old batch versus a new batch, you know, the stuff is just laminated together. It the tolerance is like, it's pretty wide. It's like 20 thou.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm just always having to dial in the offsets for it.
Right. So probing on the new Haas is going to fix all of that, I guess. Right.
I hope so. I mean, we're still probably a ways out from that's not the, we actually were talking about this. I was going to say that's not the main focus of what we're going to planning to do with the Haas in the immediate future. Like we want to get wood moved over to there.
Right.
But
right.
This, we do need to tackle our bottlenecks, and this is definitely a bottleneck for us. So it might even be a better thing to move onto the Haas than, you know, doing necks.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting. Like, you know, so talking to Mike about, you know, so Mike and I continue to be really close friends. We have a good relationship where we get to talk about, you know, the business stuff that bugs us. And one of the things we were talking about a little while ago is just like the difference between like low value boring work and high value boring work. Like, you know, like shaping a neck by hand or something, like, you know, it's not the most exciting job, I'm sure, but like it's such a critical thing to the feel of the guitar that it totally makes sense to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas like, you know, fucking around for like half an hour setting offsets to make sure that like a little countersink is happening. Like, yeah, it's like low value boring. And for me, I don't know about you, but for me, those things are like way more of a bottleneck. They're a bottleneck like emotionally and mentally as much as they are physically. You know, I don't want to do them because they're stupid jobs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What's the stupidest job you do?
Making belt loops. So the belt loops for my sheaves are made from like a really stiff nylon webbing. And so I have to like cut it with a knife to like lengths and then fold it in half and hammer it to like set the fold. And then clamp the two halves together and drill holes with like a special tool that I had to make just for drilling. Because you can't like use a drill bit on webbing.
How do you drill through that?
So I actually made like a hollow knife. So it's like a circular... it's actually made out of a drill blank. It's a circular knife that has a hollow core. And
so
you
it's
put
like
it
a
in
punch
a drill
that spins.
Yeah, exactly. So they do make punches. They make, I think they call like sail punches that you can use on webbing, but they have a taper on the outside of the punch, which means you can't really use them in like a drill guide.
Right. You're using a bushing.
Right? Yeah, exactly. So this one has very thin walls. The walls are only like 15 thou thick. And then it has a little tiny taper on the inside and the material gets forced through it. So I drilled the holes and then I have to heat seal it all. And it just seems like a stupid, stupid waste of time. You know, like
it's
low value boring
product, really. It's important.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah.
I know there's so
and
much
that's one of those
like
things
that
like so much stuff. Like I would love to solve that with a laser cutter.
Yeah.
So like CO2 lasers cut nylon webbing so nicely.
And do they leave it like melted?
Well, they heat, like heat seal the edges.
Yeah, heat seal. Right. That's so it's two in one. Getting two birds stoned at once.
And it would be like perfect every time, you know. So like but yeah, you know, as I said before, like right now I'm you know, I'm not my cash flow isn't great in the business. So like investing into you know, better machinery is not really the right idea right now, right? So
yeah,
that's why I'm working on the kitchen knife stuff.
Yeah. Well, that'll be sweet. You don't need to make a belt loop for a kitchen knife.
Well, not unless I really want to. Yeah, I'm not sure what I'm going to do for the kitchen knife in terms of packaging and stuff. You know, yeah. Another thing that sounds like a fun problem to solve.
You have to work out.
But yeah. Yeah, in that case, it's fun because it's a new thing. It's something I'm excited to finish, you know, so. Yes. So I asked what you were doing this week, and you said you're going to be doing pick cards.
Yes, some pick random cards, stuff, some post finish routing. So like, I just did one. I did a guitar for a local customer that's got a pair of P90s, which is a type of pickup, as you know.
Nice.
And yeah, so. I hate P90s.
They're not hot enough for me.
Yes. I like
maximum kill.
Yeah. You like it to sound horrible right out of the gate.
Exactly.
Blackouts. That's your favorite.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So anybody that's a guitar person will. I have a pair of Seymour Duncan Blackout active pickups in my personal guitar. Great, great pickups. So you guys aren't going to make me a guitar with Seymour Duncan Blackouts in it. Is that what you're saying?
You can swap them out.
Damn it.
No, I'll give you the full custom experience, Aaron.
Sweet. Well, it sounds like, I mean, yeah, that's high value, boring work right there.
It is.
You're not super excited about it, but it's important.
Yeah. Exactly. It gets the guitar done.
Well, I don't think my week's going to be... Yeah, I mean, I'll be doing production work for the rest of the week.
Right. How do you break that up? So Wednesday is the last day of prototyping, or was Wednesday the first day of production?
Wednesday's like the first day of production.
Right. So you get 2 days to prototype or do whatever.
Yeah.
That's a pretty cool way to do it.
Yeah, I've been trying to adopt more structure in the business because otherwise I just tend to like work all the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, like now I'm not allowed to work Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, that's good.
Because it's just been like so many years where it's just been like, you know, 10, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? So I'm trying to keep my productivity up while reducing the amount of like physical and mental stress that I'm, you know, going through in order to get there.
Right.
So, and like, to be clear, like, you know, I've said a few times this episode that like, you know, my personal take-home salary isn't that great at the moment, but... I'm not having to work like insane hours at the moment.
It is a nice trade-off.
Yes. So I need to like iron out the balance a bit, obviously. But like, yeah, I'm happy with where things are going. I think there's always a path to these things, you know.
Totally.
A slow cycle.
Yeah.
So yeah, just rest of the week is making knives.
Nice. Well, nice. That's what you're in it for.
Exactly. Yeah, things are going pretty smooth these days too, which is it's just really nice. You know, like I don't never have like broken tools. I very, very rarely have like a scrapped blade or a blade that I can't use.
Really?
Things are pretty smooth.
Unless it's been DLC coded wrong.
And then I have to redo it. Well, I mean, even then they're very rarely scrap. Usually they just get recoated.
Oh, good.
And in terms of like the machining process and the hand finishing process, like my scrap rate is approaching zero.
Wow.
Like I very, very rarely, like maybe once every couple of months, we'll have like one blade that needs some extra work or something, you know, like that's about it.
Do you ever find you have like one knife that's just like is difficult?
Very occasionally. Like, you know, sometimes I'll get a bit of steel that's been ground a little thin or a little thick, you know, and then it doesn't quite machine the way it's supposed to. But like over time, I've kind of built strategies into my machining process to mitigate those issues. So it tends to be much less of a problem these days than it used to be.
So if it's too thin or too thick, it doesn't really matter.
Basically I've built like a machining allowance in where, so like at the ricasso, which is the flat bit of the flat bit in between the handle and the blade, I'm actually machining that section of the steel now too. So that the bevel always lines up with the ricasso, even if the actual thickness of the steel varies a bit. And then the bevel is always the same thickness because I'm machining it all, you know, both sides. So yeah, these days, like things are pretty smooth, which is nice. But that probably means that I'm not doing enough development work.
You know, if things are too smooth, you're not going fast enough, right? So
you don't want it to be too easy.
Well, yeah, we'll see.
No, I know what you mean. It's like there's room for improvement if you're not pushing yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. So over the next little while, I'm going to be pushing with the kitchen knife and so on. So yeah, it's going to be exciting times.
Yeah, that's great. And hopefully soon we all have our vaccines, and because I want to come check out your shop and I want you to come hug our hoss.
Hug
as you promised to do.
And then we could record. I mean, we're just up the street from each other. We could just record episodes in person.
That'd be fun.
Be great. Yeah.
Yeah. Over dinner, a nice
steak and a beer.
Perfect. Yeah,
nice. Sounds good. Well, on that note, yeah, I will look forward to that, and I'm also going to look forward to talking to everyone again next week, and talking to you again next week. Nick.
Likewise, buddy.
I think that's a show. So we will speak to everyone next week. If you guys have questions for us, shoot us a DM or an email. It's xyz.cnc on Instagram, or you can shoot me an email at aaron@goffcustom.com. Don't email Nick. He'll be really rude to you, so don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Not customer service for this podcast is horrible.
Yeah. So yeah, I hope you guys all have a great week, and we will see you again soon.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.